It was supposed to be misty on the trail through the dense forest, but I had never been in such a dense fog that seemed to not only obscure the scenery, but also cover me in tiny droplets on a consistent basis. My clothes stuck to me, and my hair matted to my face as I walked, determined to get to the old castle that had drawn me to the forest in the first place. The trail was fortunately well worn, and I had been told by the couple running the bed and breakfast where I was staying that the view was amazing. But surrounded by the damp fog swirling around me, it was sort of a creepy sea of gray, punctuated by the dark silhouettes of the tall trees. Giving up seeing anything interesting until I got to the castle, I just put one foot in front of the other and continued down the path. And then I heard some twigs snap, and I spun around, but didn't see anything moving in the fog. Then again, from the other side, and I only saw the mist swirling around, meaning that something was in fact out there. I called out to see who it could be, but then I heard footsteps rapidly approaching, and as I turned, I saw a huge man running towards me, his hood falling back to reveal a face full of scars. The 8-foot-tall man grabbed me by the neck with one arm and lifted me up, and I stared down at his pale, scarred skin, the veins and arteries apparent under his milky white, translucent skin. I frantically hammered at his arm, clawing and punching to try and release me, and as I choked, the creature looked at me with his sickly, yellowed eyes and seemed completely unfazed by my struggles. He laughed a low, guttural cackle, and then his face twisted into one of rage, and he said, "My name is Rick Kitagawa, and this is the Inner Monster Podcast." Most people are familiar with the greenish-skinned, flat-top, hairdo-wearing, bolt-in-the-neck monster from the original Frankenstein film, but today I would like to dive into the original story of Dr. Victor Frankenstein and his monster. So first off, to clarify, the reanimated human corpse brought to life through hidden science is not actually Frankenstein. Frankenstein is the name of the doctor who reanimated the creature, as he's referred to in the original novel. Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, one, refers to the doctor, and two, is the full title of the book published by Mary Shelley back in 1818. It recounts both the life of Dr. Victor Frankenstein, as well as the life of the creation he gives life to, as well as their fateful, vengeful relationship that starts with Victor building a bride for the creature, then destroying it, leading to the creature killing Victor's wife, and ultimately culminating in the final hunt for the creature in the North Pole. There, Victor meets the ship captain who he narrates the story to, and this is where Victor eventually dies from exhaustion and hypothermia. Upon his creator's death, the creature finds that his own crimes are hideous and attempts to kill himself by floating out into the ice alone. Frankenstein is generally regarded as the first science fiction novel, and while I've long been a fan and highly recommend you reading it if you haven't yet, what interests me in terms of the podcast is how one decision to craft a giant humanoid and bring it to life haunted Frankenstein until his end. I considered, was this a bad decision, or was it really just a bad outcome? And it's this idea of decision-making that I want to explore today. So starting with my initial question of whether Dr. Frankenstein's decision to reanimate a giant humanoid was a bad decision or not, we first need to address the common confusion between a decision and an outcome. I briefly covered this in the Chupacabra episode, but decisions should not be evaluated by the quality of the outcome. Outcomes are literally what happens, and decisions are the choice made to take an action or not, which will ultimately lead to an unknown outcome. And I want to point out the uncertainty around this outcome because, after all, we are not clairvoyant. We can't tell the future, and because of this, we shouldn't evaluate a decision based on the outcome. What this means is that you can make a great decision, but have a terrible outcome. For example, opening a bar in January 2020 is, based on past sales data, probably a decent decision. Because, that said, no one could predict that in March 2020 we would see worldwide lockdowns and bars shuttering their doors. Additionally, on the flip side, you can make bad decisions but have good outcomes. Back when I had recently graduated from art school, I made a poor decision with limited data and ended up spending most of January's rent on buying blank t-shirts to print for a holiday craft fair in December. And I couldn't sleep for a few days due to the stress of knowing that if I didn't sell enough merchandise, I wasn't going to be able to pay the next month's rent. Fortunately, we sold tons of stuff that year and ended up making about 4x the investment, but I would say that was more luck than a good decision by any means. So if we truly understand that we, at the end of the day, cannot completely control outcomes, then all we can do is focus on making better decisions. We tend to make bad decisions partially because we lack a process for making decisions, and also we let our feelings get in the way. So you might think that lack of information leads to bad decisions, as in my example, and this is often true, but this can partially be resolved with part of your decision making being, well, before I make any final decisions, I need to go do more research. And that in itself is a decision making process. Often we're pressured into making a decision based on urgency, other people telling us they need a decision, or some sort of tension around time. And sometimes we literally cannot get any more information, and we eventually just need to make a decision in the midst of uncertainty. But while there are a lot of decision-making processes that you can learn, including decision trees, probability matrices, and all sorts of stuff that requires math in a great way, I think one process that I can share with you today and actually do justice in the time we have is that you want to just make sure you're writing out all of the possible decisions you could take. This is super simple, but by brainstorming all of the potential options, both realistic and somewhat fantastical, it helps decision making on a few fronts. The first is that it reminds you that you have options, and that while many of them might not be great ones, you still have them. It also can help you understand that sometimes the decision is not making a decision at all. So this process gets your creative juices circulating and may lead you to consider options that you either didn't think about or just didn't even consider actually taking. But by having a list of possible decisions, you can feel more ownership over the decision because you'll be clearer on what the actual different options are, rather than doing what most of us do and being focused on really just those first two options usually that we come up with. But I get it. For many people, decisions are scary because then you have to live with the outcome and then you have to take responsibility for said decision by living through that outcome. And you might not want to make a decision. And so this makes sense that most of our time this comes from our emotional response to making decisions. And so I want to look at the second way to make better decisions, and that is to understand the emotional component of decision making. And I want to be clear that emotions aren't a bad thing. I think in general, we don't allow ourselves to feel our feelings most of the time. But when factoring in emotions into decision making, we mainly need to be aware about what feelings are actually relevant to the decision itself. Typically, there are three types of emotions associated with decision making: incidental, imminent, and integral. Incidental feelings are usually things brought up by past experiences, which really don't have anything to do with this exact decision, but they are incidental to it. For example, if you're thinking about leaving your job to start your own business, incidental feelings might be about the fear that you felt when your parents were laid off when you were a kid, or they could be about how you watched a friend leave their job and then that company's stock skyrocketed and your friend lost out, or you might know someone who started a business and it failed. Incidental feelings are really about the past, and while these are super powerful emotions, we need to recognize that they could be influencing us in a way that would cause us to make poor decisions. Imminent emotions are those that you want to feel by getting to a certain outcome. It's about the future, and an example might be the feeling of pride you'll have in a year when you look back and can say, I left my job to start my own company at some entrepreneurs conference that you got invited to speak at, or something. And while these are often great motivators and often inspires you to make a decision, they're also often predicated on a specific outcome. In this case, on actually having a successful company, which as we learned, can be very uncertain. The last type is integral emotions, and these are the ones that you want to focus the most on and get really, really clear about. These are the emotions that are present and most directly related to the decision itself. Going with our example of leaving a job to start an entrepreneurial venture, integral emotions might be things like the anxiety you might have about telling your boss and coworkers, or the tension you might have talking this decision out with your significant other. They are directly related to the decision and not so much about the past or the future. And for myself, this is one of the hardest parts. The teasing through which emotions are relevant to the decision at hand and which ones are me projecting into the future and which ones are me being hung up on the past. And I wish that there was an easy magic solution to all of this, but I think that even being aware that there are differences in the temporality of emotions, aka is it past, present, or future, and trying one's best to stay present and focused on the decision at hand is already leagues better than letting our emotions go wild and get the best of us. So, by being present and aware of your own feelings, as well as developing your own decision-making process that you can repeatedly rely on, are just two ways to begin to make better decisions. And when you make better decisions, you can increase the odds of having better outcomes, which, at the end of the day, is what we all hope for. So, what decision-making process might you create for yourself? And what's the next decision that you can test it out on? That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Inner Monster podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to check out all of our other episodes wherever you get your podcasts or visit innermonsterpodcast.com. And if you feel so inclined, please spread the word and share this with a friend or leave a review. Or subscribe to get the podcast each week, every Inner Monster Monday. And now, a quick word from our sponsors. If you want to hear Inner Monster podcast episodes before anyone else, consider joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rickkitagawa, where you can get ad-free episodes, discounts on creepy art, and even coaching packages. That's patreon.com/rickkitagawa. I hope to see you there. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a monstrous day.